From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
This is not a Democratic election at all. This is an election based upon the choices of a fairly small number of handpicked delegates installed by the U.S. And Great Britain.
Elections in the United States are approaching. Elections in Iraq, not so fast. The U.S. refuses a prominent Shiite cleric's demands for direct elections in Iraq. We'll speak with Professor Juan Cole. The White House seeks to assert total control over all environmental and health studies and warnings. We host a debate. The U.S. awards a $100 million contract to a U.S. company to build a new Iraq media network. We'll talk with a longtime TV producer about the massive problems he saw in starting the network and then left. And finally, we hear from Main Street, USA.
And they're going to be sorry they ever messed with us.
You can't just go and kill thousands of people in Afghanistan and Iraq.
We didn't ask to be attacked.
I lost family, too.
Why would Bush want to liberate Iraq when we're not liberated ourselves?
I think we should retaliate every time.
How can you say, God bless America, when it's a whole world out here?
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In London, the 22-year-old peace activist Tom Herndl died last night. In April, he was shot in the head by Israeli forces. He'd spent the last 8 months in a vegetative state. Charges of aggravated assault were recently filed against the Israeli soldier who shot Herndl. Haaretz newspaper is reporting the charges will be likely increased to manslaughter now that Tom Herndl has died. The Israeli military has not identified the soldier by name, but said he is an Arab member of a Bedouin unit. Herndl's mother, Jocelyn, said, "We hope prosecution of the soldier involved in the shooting of Tom will send a message to all soldiers in the occupied territories that they cannot commit breaches of human rights, whether these be killing, maiming, humiliation, the destruction of homes, or the collective punishment of whole communities." We'll speak with Tom Herndl's father in a few minutes. Four Israelis have died after a female suicide bomber blew herself up at a border crossing in the northern Gaza Strip. Reuters reports Hamas and the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade jointly claimed responsibility for the attack. The Washington Post is reporting the Senate Finance Committee is asking the Internal Revenue Service to hand over confidential tax and financial records, including donor lists on dozens of Muslims, charities, and foundations. The committee is making the rare request allegedly as part of an investigation into whether the tax-exempt organizations in the United States have ties to designated terrorist groups. Ibrahim Hooper of the Council on American Islamic Relations, otherwise known as CARE, said of the Senate request for IRS records, quote, "Are they now going to start a witch hunt of all the donors of these now closed relief organizations so that Muslims feel they're going to be targeted once more based on their charitable giving?" Among the groups targeted are the SAR Foundation, Global Relief, the Holy Land Foundation for Relief and Development, the Muslim World League, the World Assembly of Muslim Youth, and the Islamic Society of North America. In an attempt to restore relations with Canada, President Bush announced Tuesday Canadian companies will be allowed to bid on contracts to rebuild Iraq. The U.S. had previously barred Canada along with France, Germany, and Russia and India because the nations did not back the U.S. invasion of Iraq. President Bush met with the Prime Minister of Canada at his meeting in Mexico. The New York Times is reporting that at the time of his capture, Saddam Hussein was carrying a copy of a letter he had sent to Iraqi resistance fighters, urging them to beware of foreign Arab fighters entering Iraq to fight U.S. troops. The Times says the letter offers additional evidence that questions the Bush administration's assertion of ties between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. The Washington Post is reporting that top administration officials ordered the rewriting of a federal study on health care that had originally concluded minorities receive less care and less high-quality care than whites. The report originally said the disparities in care along racial lines presented, quote, national problems, But those words never appeared in the final version released by the Department of Health and Human Services. Critics said the department rewrote the study to put a positive spin on a public health crisis. The final report says disparities in care were influenced not just by race, but by geography and socioeconomic factors. Democratic Congressmember Henry Waxman of California said, quote, "In effect, they whitewashed the issue away, even though they were told that healthcare disparities are a national problem." The Guardian of London is reporting the U.S. is now offering to help pay for Russia to withdraw from its two remaining military bases in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. Russia has agreed to a request by the new Georgian government to leave, but said a full exit may take 11 years. The Guardian reports Washington has been slowly increasing its presence in Georgia. On Tuesday, U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Len Pasco also offered Georgia about $3 million in new aid to train Georgian troops. 77 heavily armored vehicles also arrived to help in the trainings. President Bush is expected to ask today for a $1 billion boost to NASA's budget over the next 5 years to fund the start of a new campaign in space to put a permanent base on the moon within 20 years and for U.S. astronauts to land on Mars sometime after 2030. Meanwhile, Republican Congressmember Tom Feeney of Florida has publicly said the United States has the, quote, moral capability and authority to take control of space. Feeney said on the cable news show Scarborough Country, quote, "Whoever is able to dominate space will be able to control the destiny of the entire Earth. And I think America is the only country with the moral capability and authority to do so." Again, the words of Republican Congressman Tom Feeney of Florida. In Iran, President Mohammad Khatami has threatened to resign if reformist politicians are not allowed to run for office in next month's parliamentary elections. 27 governors have also threatened to resign in protest. On Tuesday, former Vermont Governor Howard Dean won the non-binding Democratic primary in Washington, D.C., with 43% of the vote. The Reverend Al Sharpton came in second with 34%. Ambassador Carol Moseley Braun and Congressman Dennis Kucinich came in a distant third and fourth. None of the other major candidates participated in the symbolic primary. Dean celebrated his victory by calling supporters in Washington. He noted he'd taken first place among an electorate with a majority of African-American voters. He said, quote, "We're going to build a rainbow coalition to take over this country for the people who own it." This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the Iowa caucus and New Hampshire primaries approach, the D.C. primary just ended. Election season is entering full swing. In November, U.S. citizens will go to the polls to elect the president. But in U.S.-occupied Iraq, it's a different story. Washington's policy there is to stifle the calls from Iraqis for immediate direct elections. Iraq's most senior Shiite Muslim cleric, Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, has repeatedly demanded a swift electoral process, one person, one vote, to determine a new Iraqi government. But the United States has rejected the calls. Washington wants to have indirect elections to form a transitional Iraqi assembly that would then form an interim government. The Bush administration said yesterday it's reviewing how the new government will be selected after Sistani warned of increased political tensions and violence if direct elections are not held within months. But the U.S. has maintained a countrywide direct election would not be plausible before the June 30th deadline for a political handover to Iraqis. Top U.S. administrator in Iraq, Paul Bremer, told CNN, quote, We are Democrats to our very bones. We have been practicing democracy for 200 years. Elections are always the best way to select a representative government. The problem is the problem we have is time, he said. A short time ago, I spoke with Professor Juan Cole. He's professor of modern Middle East and South Asian history at the University of Michigan, runs an analytic website called Informed Comment, in which he provides a daily roundup of news and events in Iraq and elsewhere in the Arab world. The address, juancole.com. Cole speaks fluent Arabic, Persian, Urdu, and has lived all over the Muslim world. He also continues to research Iran and Shiite Islam, the subject of his Sacred Space and Holy War. The book collects some of the work on the history of Shiite branch of Islam in modern Iraq and Gulf. I asked him to talk about Paul Bremer's comments.
Well, the problem from the point of view of the Iraqis who want free and open elections is that the elections that are now envisaged by Mr. Bremer have a very narrow base. They will be conducted by municipal or provincial councils, which were appointed by the Americans or the British. And it is those hand-picked members of provincial councils who will choose the majority of the delegates to the Electoral College, which in turn will choose a parliament. The American-appointed interim governing council, which oversees all of Iraq, will also be able to appoint a certain number of persons to the most basic level of the electorate. So this is not a democratic election at all. This is an election based upon the choices of a fairly small number of handpicked delegates installed by the U.S. and Great Britain.
The Shiite cleric Ayatollah Ali Sistani has rejected the plan for a transitional national assembly chosen by caucus-selected delegates to assume power on June 30th. So you have the Shiites calling for majority rule, and although Bremer says he supports it, it doesn't look that way.
Yes, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani has insisted that that these elections, which are scheduled for the end of May, be held on a one-person, one-vote basis throughout the country. He wants this, he says, because only such elections could guarantee that the will of the sovereign Iraqi people was represented in the government that then emerged. So he's talking very much like Jean-Jacques Rousseau or something. He's talking about sovereignty residing in the body politic. And he thinks that an election based upon these appointed provincial councils simply would not be democratic and would not have democratic results. And I think he's also afraid that the U.S. and the United Kingdom, when they appointed these members of provincial councils, often favored ex-Baathists who had cooperated at some point with them in overthrowing Saddam and who tended to be Sunni Arabs. And so I think Sistani is afraid that these councils will produce a government that's not only not legitimate but also not representative.
You have an unusual situation where the Islamic clerics, the Shiite clerics, are calling for elections, and the U.S. is saying, hold on, at the same time that here in the United States, we're going through our own election process. This is not very much emphasized in the press. Now, you read the world's press, the Arab press, every night, and people can go to your website at juancole.com and see the digest of that every day. Can you talk about what we're missing when we watch and read papers and watch television in this country that you're gathering from your journeys through the Arab press?
Oh, the American public is missing a lot of the story on the ground in Iraq. The level of detail that you can get from the American press is usually very low. And there's not much emphasis upon the speeches and the actions of actual Iraqis, including members even of the American-appointed interim governing council, Most Americans who followed the story from the American press don't know where these individuals stand on various issues, and it's only when a crisis emerges that that they're zeroed in on. So I would say that the agency of the Iraqi people, the ability of the Iraqi people to influence events, to have an impact on how the Coalition Provisional Authority develops, all of this has been downplayed. The story in the Western press usually has centered on the American administration of the country or the American military. And it has tended, I think, to cut both a lot of slack. And I have friends on the ground in Iraq. I don't mean to put down what they're doing. A lot of them are doing excellent work. But there have been a lot of problems in the way that this has unfolded. And those problems, I think, are much more serious than is reflected in most of the mainstream reporting.
What would Iraq look like if they had elections today? What would the government look like?
Well, if you had a parliamentary election on a free and open basis at the moment, I think it's probably true that a lot of the parliamentary deputies would be radicals of one sort or another. And this is the thing that Mr. Bremer is afraid of and the reason for which he refuses to have the open elections now. I think the radical Shiite cleric Muqtada Sadr, who is more or less a Khomeinist, a follower of the ideas of Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran, and who would very much like to see the Shiite clerics rule, to see a strict form of Islamic law implemented and so forth, that his followers likely would get a good third of the seats from the Shiite areas, that other religious parties would do well among the Shiites, that there is no major secular party that's demonstrated any real strength or momentum since the fall of Saddam that would attract Shiite votes. In the Sunni areas, I think you'd get Sunni fundamentalist Muslims and ex-Baathists or even maybe Sunni Arab nationalists who tilt towards the Baath elected, and the Kurdish areas would elect probably mainly the two main parties, are the ones that the U.S. has been cooperating with in the last 10 years. The Kurdish side of it is not so mysterious. But all of these have their own agendas. The Shiites very much want Shiite rule and Islamic law from a Shiite perspective. The Kurds want much more autonomy than the Arabs, for the most part, want to grant them, and a lot of very key conflicts about the future of Iraq have just been postponed, and it's worrisome to me that the United States seems intent upon withdrawing its civilian administration from the country and just letting the Iraqis fight it out.
We're talking to Professor Juan Cole, who teaches modern Middle East and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and runs an analytic website called Informed Consent, in which he provides a daily roundup of news and events in Iraq and elsewhere in the Arab world, the website juancole.com. The resistance on the ground right now, the latest news, another U.S. soldier killed, Ukrainian troops firing over the heads of Kut protesters, another helicopter, U.S. helicopter downed. Who are the resistance today after the capture of Saddam Hussein?
Well, the resistance is multiple. The main source of resistance has been Sunni Arabs of various backgrounds. Some of them are fundamentalist Muslims. Some of them are Sunni Arab nationalists. Some of them are remnants of the old Ba'ath Party and its military and security apparatus. So, probably 60%. Of the attacks have occurred in the Sunni Arab heartland. But then there have been attacks on coalition forces. in the Shiite areas, not so many, and for the most part, they have tended not to be very successful. There's been relatively little loss of life or injury from these kinds of attacks, presumably mainly by Shiite forces who are dissatisfied at one point or another with the American and British administration of the country. The Kurdish regions have been relatively quiet in this respect, but there's another kind of social violence and trouble that has emerged occasionally beyond an active resistance to the to what they think of as the occupation. And that is urban disturbances by crowds with various sorts of grievances. We've seen, as you say, in Kut and Amara, unemployment riots, people demonstrating, becoming violent even over their lack of jobs, their lack of money, the long fuel lines, the lack of infrastructure, and so forth. They're becoming hopeless about the situation. And demanding that the Coalition Provisional Authority do something about it. But then there have also been Shiite protests demanding Islamic law in Baghdad and in Basra. There have been communal riots in Kirkuk, in the northern city, which is one-third Turkmen, one-third Kurdish, and one-third Arab, and where the ethnic mix is volatile, and the question of the future of the city, what ethnic group is going to dominate it, is very much in play. And in each of these kinds of urban disturbances, coalition troops have sometimes fired on demonstrators, killed them. I think the Ukrainians actually, I initially reported that they had fired over their heads, as the wire services said, but it's now being reported that a good seven civilians were injured, and I think there was one unconfirmed report of a death.
And the latest news from the former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, and why you label that story in your website, juancole.com, a Cheney coup d'etat?
Well, it's beginning to seem to me, of course, I'm not a Washington insider, and so I can't be absolutely sure of this, but it's beginning to seem to me that there's some evidence for Cheney, Vice President Dick Cheney, playing a kind of role in this administration with regard to foreign policy and military affairs that's simply very unusual with regard to the roles of past vice presidents. Cheney was part of the Project for a New American Century, which attempted to put pressure on Bill Clinton in 1998 to go to war against Iraq. So we know he came into office with a determination to have an Iraq war. And that's not a surprise, and O'Neill's reports confirm this. But what's surprising in what O'Neill says is that George W. Bush himself appears very early on in the administration to have been persuaded by of the case for war against Iraq, and that surprised me because in his campaign, at least, he had argued against foreign adventurism and against nation building, and had criticized Clinton even for going into Little Haiti and so forth. And so I had assumed that that the people in the administration who were part of the project for the New American Century, like Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, and others, had probably been frustrated early in the Bush administration because Bush probably wasn't so gung-ho on those sorts of things. But now the picture that O'Neill paints is one of Bush sort of asking for a pretext for an Iraq war, even as early as January and February of 2001.
Juan Cole, professor of Middle East Studies, Modern Middle East and South Asian History at the University of Michigan. His website is juancole.com.
This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
عتقوها أمي فلسطين لا تدوزوها دركوها جنات الخلد لا تفوتوها عتقوها أمي فلسطين لا تدوزوها دركوها جنات الخلد لا تفوتوها حبوها كيف الحياة كاملة جعلوها
Shahabi Nass here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. has awarded a $96 million contract to a U.S. producer of communications equipment, Harris Corporation, to create a U.S.-funded national media network in Iraq. According to the head of Harris Corp., the Iraqi media network will have 30 TV and radio transmitters, 3 broadcast studios, and 12 bureaus around Iraq. After U.S.-led troops ousted Saddam Hussein's regime in April, the state-run broadcasters were seized. Since then, they've been run by a U.S. military contractor, Science Applications International Corporation. Its efforts came under criticism from some for the inadequate audience the programs gathered and management problems. Today, we'll talk to a longtime TV producer, Don North, about the problems he saw in starting the network. He recently wrote an article for Television Week entitled Iraq Project Frustration, One Newsman's Take on How Things Went Wrong. Don North joins us on the phone. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
Can you tell us your story? When did you go to Iraq? Who were you working for and what were you doing there?
I first went to Iraq in February and joined my old buddies, the 101st Airborne, to go into Iraq with them and make a TV documentary. I'd been with the 101st covering them as a journalist in Vietnam, so it was great to be back with the 101st. And after the fall of Baghdad, I was hired by SAIC, Science Applications International, to help establish the Iraq Media Network, first radio and then television in Iraq.
And what exactly did you do? How did you establish it?
Well, we within a few days of landing in Baghdad, we were broadcasting radio to the Iraqi nation out of a tent in Baghdad. And we were a small group of about a dozen Americans and Iraqi expats who went in to do this. All of us experienced in various aspects of broadcasting and technical expertise. And we got radio going, and it was quite popular. The Iraqis obviously were happy to hear radio journalism that wasn't state-controlled or Ba'athist or Saddam-controlled. And initially, we were quite welcomed. And within a few weeks, we got television running. We went on the air May 13th with television. But unfortunately, I mean, it's been 9 months now since we established radio and television, presumably an independent, democratic media. The Iraqis need a new voice, and somehow we have got it all mixed up. The Coalition Provisional Authority, Ambassador Bremer's organization, doesn't seem to be able to differentiate between public diplomacy, in other words, telling Iraqis and the world what we Americans are trying to do in Iraq, and giving the Iraqis a voice of independence that they need themselves. That's been the problem.
Can you talk about who they chose to do the news? Who were the people who were creating it? How much control did the U.S. media have over the information, and ultimately why you left?
Well, I think the people that were hired by SAIC if I may say so, including myself, we're highly experienced people. I've been a journalist since I was 21, covering the Vietnam War. I've recently been involved in training journalists, particularly television and radio journalists, in Bosnia, in Afghanistan, in Romania, particularly countries that are emerging from tyranny. So I think I had a sense of what it was the Iraqis needed after 35 years of controlled media. Our news director was a young Iraqi expat, Ahmed Al-Rikabi, who had grown up in Sweden and was a producer and a reporter for Swedish television. He'd broadcast for the BBC. He'd broadcast for the Free Iraq Radio. And he was well-respected by Iraqis. But we immediately started clashing with coalition provisional authorities who wanted control. They just couldn't resist controlling the message. And unfortunately, they turned what should have been an independent voice for Iraqis. This was our aim, to sort of make a PBS, a public broadcast radio and TV for the Iraqis. But instead, it just became a mouthpiece for the coalition, and the Iraqis didn't find it credible. They just thought of it as another voice of America and turned to other satellite broadcasters like Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya, Arabic stations broadcasting into Iraq. Those are the stations that they're watching and not a station that was created for them.
Don North, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We had a military wife on who was describing her husband working with the Iraqi media as well, and he was saying that the Iraqis there, bristling under the U.S. control, was calling the U.S. people in charge little Saddams.
Oh, dear. Well, it's unfortunate. I mean, with all the best intentions, we are trying to bring democracy to Iraq. In a way, we are imposing a democracy, and a free and independent media, I think, is the bulwark, the cornerstone of any democracy. But somehow, even though we ourselves have created and established a marvelous democracy of our own, we don't seem to be able to transfer this and export this to people who are hungry for it and really want it, like the Iraqis.
Don North, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Don North has written a piece in Television Week about the Iraqi media called Iraq Project Frustration, One Newsman's Take on How Things Went Wrong. And you are listening to Democracy Now! Coming up on the program, we're going to be going to Main Street USA with journalist John Alpert. We also hope to speak with Tom Herndl's father, the young man who is in the occupied territories as a peace activist and was shot dead by an Israeli soldier. Well, shot yesterday, he died. Right now, we turn to a debate. Tomorrow is the last day that federal agencies responsible for public health and safety and the environment have to respond to a controversial new proposal by the White House to strip them of their authority to declare emergencies. The administration's plan calls for the White House Office of Management and Budget to decide what and when the public would be told about an outbreak of mad cow disease, an anthrax release, a nuclear plant accident, or any other crisis. Perhaps more troubling to the scientific community, the White House also wants to manage scientific and technical evaluations, known as peer reviews, of all major government rules, plans, proposed regulations, and pronouncements. Under the present system, each federal agency controls its emergency notifications and peer review of its projects. On Friday, a nonpartisan group of 20 former top agency officials sent a letter to the OMB asking the White House agency to withdraw its proposal, saying it could, quote, damage the federal system for protecting public health and the environment.
The letter was obtained by the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Among its signers, two former Environmental Protection Agency administrators, a former Secretary of Labor, two former heads of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, a former Assistant Labor Secretary, and 13 other former senior officials of both political parties. The letter was also signed by David Michaels, former Assistant Secretary for the Environment, Safety and Health at the Department of Energy. He joins us on the telephone right now. David Michaels, your response to this latest White House proposal.
Good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us.
Thank you. Not just me, but the entire science community is up at arms. It's code red. The proposal the White House has made is not peer review. It resembles peer review, but it's a whole different system, and it's really being set up to handcuff the regulatory apparatus. It's going to stop agencies from issuing regulations, issuing protections of the public's health and the environment. It's even going to stop web pages from going up. And this is written so broadly that agencies will have really no ability to put out information without first having that information being vetted and criticized by the industries it's trying to regulate.
We're also joined on the phone by William Kovacs, Vice President for Environment, Technology, and Regulatory Affairs, the primary officer responsible for developing U.S. Chamber policy on the environment, natural resources, agriculture, food safety, regulatory, and technology issues at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Why do you support this?
Well, good morning. We support it for a few reasons. One is the cost of the regulatory system today is $850 billion annually. And when you're talking about imposing that many costs, and that's four times more dollars than are imposed than are paid by all the taxes of all the corporations in the entire United States, when they're putting out a major rule that might cost billions of dollars, what we're saying is it really needs to be peer-reviewed by other scientists, and the peer review needs to be transparent. And I don't know how anyone could say we're harming science if all we're saying is whatever the government does, it needs to do in public, and it needs to allow the public to know what it is doing and to get outside of doing everything in a back room.
Well, you know, I have a number of responses to that. The first
David is, Michaels.
There is no evidence that this is needed. The White House has not identified a single regulation that would have been improved by peer review. And I can think of dozens of public health and environmental protections that this process would have delayed with a significant impact on the public's health. The next thing, though, is the science community calls peer review something that's very different than what the White House is calling it. And don't take my word for it. The editor of Science Magazine a couple of weeks ago, the leading scientific journal in the world, said it was strange to call this thing peer review. And it's dangerous to put all this power into the White House, the Office of Management and Budget, could result in some public health emergencies being missed or delayed, response delayed. It's a very problematic proposal.
Well, let me respond to all of that. First of all, in emergency situations, if there is that kind of critical situation, there is an exemption in the proposed rule. So that's really a specious argument. The second thing is there are two types of peer reviews. It's not that all peer review is equal. For most of the regulations, and we're talking about 4,000 new regulations a year, for 3,850 of those regulations, the peer review process that the agencies have today probably would be sufficient, and that's what the agencies are going to use. But there's a section of the regulations called especially significant, and these are the regulations that have a major impact on the economy. There are about 150 of them a year. And for those 150 that literally have hundreds of billions of dollars of costs associated with them, for that set of regulations, there's going to have to be peer review. And most of those regulations occur over years. For example, a lot of the clean air regulations relating to nitric oxide or sulfur dioxide, the criteria pollutants, those things take typically 4 to 6 years to develop. We're not talking about emergency situations. We're talking about long, thoughtful, drawn-out regulations. And right now, all of those regulations are made in the back room by government agencies, by unelected officials, and who keep all of their scientific studies private.
That's simply not true. The regulations that Mr. Kovacs is talking about all go through a public process where people can put in comments and they're reviewed. What this regulation, this proposal talks about is all the science that underlies these regulations, hundreds and hundreds of studies. I put out a regulation on beryllium when I was Assistant Secretary of Energy. It's 10 times stronger than the OSHA regulation. We had many dozens of studies that would have had to have gone through cumbersome peer review that clearly weren't needed if this proposal were in place. And the costs would have been huge. If we're worried about costs, the cost in money and in lives of this proposal is enormous.
You know, that's one point. You know, you're right. But when you put out your the reason you don't want to put out your studies is because you want to keep everything in the background, everything secret, so that when you put it out for public comment, you say, well, here's what the government is willing to let you see. But you never want to give anyone the backup data so that they can determine whether the science is good or bad. And the peer review will take the science and will put it in the public. And why shouldn't the public, before you're going to impose a regulation costing billions of dollars, have the right to see whether the science is any good?
All that science,
David Michaels,
it's nonsense. Every one of those studies is put out for public consumption. The problem is, according to the White House, is all of those studies haven't been reviewed by a peer review panel, not of scientists selected independently, but scientists who have essentially with a stacked deck. The way this is written is if you're a university scientist who gets federal money, you couldn't be on this peer review panel because you might be biased in favor of the agency. But if you're an industry scientist, you could be chosen to be on this panel.
Now, that is not where the regulations go. Where the regulations go is in terms of complete disclosure. They, right now, in the academic community, in the journal, in the scientific journals, what happens is all the peer review is done by anonymous scientists. They sit there. They don't tell you who they are. They have whatever kind of input they want. And then all of a sudden you say, this is it's been peer reviewed, but nobody knows what the comments are. What these regulations require for major regulations or what is the identity of the scientist, who they are. Do they have a bias? Do they have a financial interest?
The government, you can't be on it unless there's a waiver. And that rules out most top experts in every field.
You can't peer review your own work.
No, it's not the work. If the CDC is issuing something on lead poisoning, if you're a scientist and you get any NIH money, which is most scientists in the medical world, you can't even be on this peer review.
That is not what it's saying. Otherwise, you wouldn't have anyone. What it's saying is full disclosure, so there's a transparency.
Let me ask a question. We're talking to William Kovacs, Vice President for Environment, Technology, and Regulatory Affairs at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and David Michaels, former Assistant Secretary for Environment, Safety, and Health at the Department of Energy, debating a new proposal that the White House has put forward that would decide what and when the public would be told about an outbreak of, say, mad cow disease, anthrax release, nuclear plant accident, or any other crisis. Let me pose what happened after 9/11. It was very unusual, and people were very angry, especially New Yorkers, after the calamity of 9/11, when it came out that the White House had put direct pressure on the EPA not to release information about how toxic the environment was right around this area, actually where we're broadcasting, right around Ground Zero. But that was considered unusual. And when the suppression came out, my colleague Juan Gonzalez, co-host here and a reporter at the New York Daily News, was exposed this, the level of toxins in the environment, the EPA not putting out the report. It came out the White House had put pressure. Would this then become business as usual under this new regulation? Let me ask David Michaels.
It would certainly raise the White House's ability to control fundamental information that agencies need to put out. The other thing it would do is allow the White House to say, wait a minute, don't put anything out. Let's have a peer review. Let's look at this. Let's slow it down and essentially serve the same purpose.
I'm not sure. It depends what it is. This regulation applies to regulations.
No, it applies to all information, including statements and reports.
It applies primarily to regulations. But our position here at the U.S. Chamber is very simple. We believe that the entire approach for information and data quality is the right approach. All of the information needs to be accurate. All of it needs to be released to the public. All of it needs to be transparent. And it's the scientific community that is making the argument. You know, David, you're making two arguments. One, you're saying, gee, it's going to hurt science, and now you're saying, gee, they can control the information. What we're saying is all of the information needs to be released, all of it, immediately. When the study is produced, it needs to be released. If they're going to use it for anything, if they're going to use it for any governmental purpose, the underlying scientific information needs to be released, and it needs to be peer-reviewed. End of discussion. There needs to be complete and total transparency
but,
in the
but
system.
But the Chamber of Commerce takes the position that peer review in a scientific journal is not good enough. They want the stack deck peer review that the White House puts together.
No, what we said on a scientific journal, let's be accurate, is that if you're going to use the data that is derived from a scientific journal, then you have to release the names of the peer reviewers, and it has to be done in the same way anything else would be done, and that is in a very transparent way.
David Michaels and William Kovacs, I want to give you the example read in our headlines today. Washington Post is reporting top administration officials ordered the rewriting of a federal study on health care that had originally concluded minorities received less care and less high-quality care than whites. The report originally said the disparities in care along racial lines presented, quote, national problems. But those words never appeared in the final version released by the Department of Health and Human Services. Critics said the department rewrote the study to put a positive spin on this public health crisis. Your response, William Kovacs?
Well, my response is I don't know how it's being used, and I don't know what the underlying studies are. But what we would argue is that the underlying studies need, if they're going to rely on them, need to be released.
What this is about is this is the strategy the tobacco industry came up with a long time ago. If you don't like the policy, attack the science. And what it's going on it, over and over again in so many examples, essentially, you can centralize control somewhere like the White House. They could go in and say, well, we don't like this study, so pull it out. We don't like this study, pull it out. And what you have left is a politically acceptable report that doesn't improve the public health or the environment. And this
David,
is one more
but you started out by saying how we need to have scientists have control over the process so the stuff doesn't be released. And now you're arguing that the White House has done just what you wanted to do. Why don't you just say the scientific community needs to join the business community and we need to have transparency when we're dealing with science that impacts the public?
I don't trust the business community to peer review good science. There are too many examples of where the business community essentially, like tobacco, says, you know, the science isn't there. This is what's going on with global warming.
Look, the business community creates
I'm going to interrupt because we have to wrap up.
United States.
The business community, you said, creates all the jobs in the entire United States.
And so he shouldn't, David shouldn't be so antagonistic to us. I mean, the business community has created the greatest environment in the world. We have the best quality of life in the United States. And to sit there and say the scientists know better and we should be able to make decisions in dark rooms is foolish. We need transparency in the process.
Speaking of transparency, as we wrap up, this is a proposal put forward by the White House. What kind of input does the public have at this point?
Anyone in the public can comment on the proposal.
Until when?
The best way to do this is to go to www.ombwatch.org. They've set up a website specifically to get comments into Congress and to the
and
White
is
House.
There is there a deadline? Is there a deadline?
OMB Watch is an interest group that supports David's position.
Absolutely.
You go directly to OMB, www.gov.omb, and that is the way to do it. Put it right into the channel so that it's part of all the other comments. Again,
and is there a deadline?
Transparency. The deadline's passed, but I'm sure that they're still accepting comments.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. William Kovacs of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, David Michaels, former Assistant Secretary for Environment, Safety, and Health of the Department of Energy. You are listening to Democracy Now!, and we'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now! I am Amy Goodman. In London last night, 22-year-old British peace activist Tom Herndl died. In April, Herndl was shot in the head by an Israeli soldier. He'd spent the last 8 months in a vegetative state. Charges of aggravated assault were recently filed against the Israeli soldier who shot Herndl. Haaretz is reporting the charges will likely be increased to manslaughter now that Herndl has died. We're joined on the phone right now by Carl Arundel, who is a family spokesperson in Britain. Welcome to Democracy Now!
It's a privilege to be on the show. I'm sorry about the circumstances. I have to say that although the family have been aware that Tom inevitably would die, it nevertheless is no less a shock when it happened last night. And the family left the hospital in the early hours of this morning, and they were visibly exhausted and shaken.
Right now, the latest news is that the soldier that shot Tom Herndl, that the Israeli military has identified, the charges will be increased against him. What is your response, the family's response?
Well actually, the point is, at the moment, he has been indicted as of Monday with six charges. The principal charge was aggravated assault. Now, that assumes that the victim is still alive. When the victim dies, that may automatically switch to a charge of manslaughter. Crucially, aggravated assault and manslaughter both assume that the soldier had no intention of killing Tom. Now, the family very significantly contests that the soldier intended to kill Tom. He shot Tom through a telescopic lens at a distance of 150 meters through the center of his forehead with a single shot. There was no crossfire, no return fire. It was, in his own confession, a shot at a person who was unarmed. I don't think you need to have a ballistics degree to understand that that was a shot intended to kill. So the family are very clear. This soldier murdered Tom Herndl, and they believe that the correct indictment is for murder and that this soldier should be prosecuted for murder.
Carl Arundel, I want to thank you for being with us, spokesperson for Tom Herndl's family. Tom is a peace activist from Britain who was in the occupied territories and was killed by an Israeli soldier. He has spent the last 8 months in a vegetative state. And you are listening to Democracy Now! As we move back to the United States. The D.C. primary has just taken place. Howard Dean won that primary. He was followed by Al Sharpton and then Carol Moseley Braun and Dennis Kucinich. Now the Iowa caucuses are in a few days, and then the New Hampshire primary. John Alpert, who runs Downtown Community Television, where we are based here in Chinatown, just blocks from Ground Zero, who is a journalist who has won many awards and world renown, has gone across the country with a team of people with his cyber car, the DCTV cyber car, to get a sense of how people feel about issues around the country. And he joins us in the studio now. Welcome, John.
Hi, good morning.
It's good to have you with us.
Thanks.
Before we start, let's just get a clip of the voices of people that you've spoken to around the country.
And they're going to be sorry they ever messed with us.
We can't just go and kill thousands of people in Afghanistan and Iraq.
We didn't ask to be attacked.
I lost family, too.
Why would Bush want to liberate Iraq when we're not liberated ourselves?
I think we should retaliate every time.
How can you say, God bless America, when it's a whole world out here?
Main Street USA, John, this program is going to be airing on Link TV tonight on DirecTV, satellite TV. Can you talk about this as we take a little trip with you and hear some of the voices?
Well, we had been in the past 2 years to Ground Zero on September 11th. We were in Afghanistan and we were in Iraq. And we took footage from those places. We put it on the cybercar. The cybercar has a big video wall on the side of it. And we drove around to main streets all over America had impromptu town meetings. We showed these clips, and we got the reactions of people from all over the country. It was really astonishing because we didn't know what to expect.
Let's go to the next clip. This is from
Main
Street, USA.
As a mother, how do you feel about the clip you just saw?
My heart goes out for her. I mean, anybody that has children or family, seeing clips like that, it brings it back to a human thing that they're hurting just as much as us. You know, that, like, I have three sons. It would just devastate me if I lost one.
What should we say to someone like that?
I don't know what you can say. I mean, nothing. No matter what we say is going to bring her child back. I mean, we can say we're sorry, we can come in, we help, but for the rest of her life, she'll never have that boy, never see the dreams of what he was going to be, what kind of man he was going to be. I mean, I don't think you can ever say anything. It's going to make up the loss of her child.
Can you tell us what she was responding to?
Yeah, that's a firewoman from Anderson, Indiana. When we showed up on Main Street in Anderson, all the firemen came with their trucks to watch our tape. They were especially interested in what happened at Ground Zero. But we showed them a clip from a suburban neighborhood in Baghdad that the United States dropped cluster bombs on. And a woman in the tape was mourning the death of her 18-year-old son. And before we showed that tape, I would say that everybody in the audience, with the exception of one man, was very supportive of the war and what was going on there. And that shook them up, especially this woman, when she began thinking of what it would be like if she lost her son.
Can you introduce another clip for us?
Well, every town we went to, it was really different. We went to so many towns, I don't know what town's next on this tape, maybe. So.
Well, let's just take a listen, right, and then you can respond.
Who thinks going into Iraq is a good idea?
I think it's definitely a good idea. Not only for us, but for those people that are so oppressed by that dictator, they're living worse than what our American slaves ever had to live. And that's what a lot of people forget and they don't remember. And when this is over, the United States will go in and they'll build schools and hospitals and help educate those people.
They'll go in there and rebuild schools, there'll be hospitals and everything else. But they won't leave the money here in the United States to take care of what they should take care of first. Charity begins at home.
We don't have streets. You've been on our streets. We don't have hospitals. There are more prisons being built than there are schools. Take care of home first. That's why I think it was a bad idea.
Are excerpts from Palestine, Arkansas, population 700. Mayor Willetta Clark, who used to be chopping cotton in the cotton fields as a sharecropper. The big issue in that town are the deaths from the railroad trains. They don't have enough money to put a crossing guard there, and every single year two or three people get killed, and they're angry. They felt that the money was being spent on the other side of the world when they needed it spent in Arkansas. Another place that was really interesting was Yazoo City, Mississippi. And the mayor of that town, Mayor Clark, the first black mayor, Wardell Leach, the first black mayor that they've ever had in Yazoo City, was holding an impromptu meeting based around the cybercar.
And people will get a sense of that tonight on Link TV. What time is this broadcasting? Main Street, USA.
8 p.m.
And that does it for the program. John Alpert, thanks very much for being with us. Democracy Now! Broadcasting on the other TV satellite in this country on Dish Network, Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, as well as on Pacifica Radio and NPR stations around the country, community media, public access TV stations around the country. If you'd like a copy of the show, you can call 1-800-881-2359. Our website, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabio Caduceo, and Nagara Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill. A very special happy birthday to Uri Galed, our director. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.